Nor an alcoholic.
Hello.
It is now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker. She's a very dear friend of mine, and she's really just a grounding force to so many people in recovery. The way that she shares her recovery through how she lives speaks volumes, and I'm so excited for you guys to hear her story tonight. Let's welcome Jerry.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me okay? All right. Any reverb or anything like that, you know, to break out with some air guitar. Man, there's a lot of you guys, and I'm really glad that aging has given me cataracts. So if I didn't say hi to you, it's because I couldn't see you. I'm literally better off without my glasses right now. So okay. So I am an alcoholic, absolutely, and I have a history of embellishing my drinking with other substances, and so that's all I would say about that. I used other things so I could drink longer and drink competitively. I actually grew up in a family where everybody in my family was alcoholic. I didn't think they were. I thought we were all normal. Because my mom and dad, you know, were working people, they were able to hold jobs and, you know, provide for our family and all of that. My dad was a principal, which I didn't like. And my mom was a bookkeeper. And we were latchkey kids, which I absolutely loved. And I grew up in Lemoore, which is not very far from here. You guys all know where that's at, right? I've gotten past being embarrassed to tell anybody that's where I'm from, but I used to feel really embarrassed about that. I don't even know why. I think it was just because I felt like I didn't ever really belong there. And but I had a lot of friends, and, you know, the way I had all those friends was by going to parties and drinking and being under the influence, and I never really felt like I could get along with anybody without being under the influence. I started drinking when I was 11, and I didn't even realize the reason why. I thought I was just doing it because everybody else was, and my brother was 3 years older than me, and I really liked hanging out with all the older people because I never really felt my age. I look now at people who are 11, 12, I mean, like my grandchildren when they were growing up. Yeah, that's another thing that comes with recovery. Stay alive long enough to have grandchildren. But I looked at them as they were growing up and thinking, God, I was that age when I was drinking. You know, I just never really thought that I just never really saw myself as young. I know now it's because I went through some traumatic stuff. I was grabbed by a man when I was 10 years old and held at knife point. And from that point on, I really didn't feel like I was who I was. I didn't make eye contact with people because I was sure that you could see inside my soul. I was taller than everybody else in my class. I was the same height I am now in the fourth grade. I used to say I was a quarter inch shorter, but I'm old, so I'm the same height now. You shrink a little bit. So I always thought I was tall until I had friends that were tall, and then I realized I wasn't that tall, but it's because I was taller than everybody. All the boys were midgets, I thought. And so I just never really, I felt like this Amazon, like big, and I felt like I was fat, and I had braces. I got braces on my teeth when I was 7, and they didn't come off until right before I went to high school. And that was because I said, I will not go to school if these are still on my teeth. and I had to wear a face bow, and I had to have this thing in the roof of my mouth that I had to crank. I felt like such a geek. And so I tried desperately to belong somewhere. And so I gravitated to my brother's friends, and they were already drinking and using, and so that just, they became my people, you know. What I know now is that I think most of all of us in that stage of our life had experienced some sort of trauma, and we were all trying to heal it through drinking. I know for sure that at least my girlfriends had. And so this is when my life starts to get a little crazy. So my mother and father got a divorce. My dad came in when I was, I think I was a sophomore in high school. So my brother just graduated from high school, and they had this kegger, which was such a weird thing, right? Because my parents would say, no drinking, no using drugs. But then when my brother graduates from high school, they get him a keg. Where did that mixed message come from? So I was out partying with my friends, and who were all 10 years older than me, at least. My boyfriend at the time was 25 years old. And I had no idea that meant he was a perv, but, at the time I just thought, cool, look at me, I'm so popular, you know, this guy really thinks I'm great, but he actually spread some rumors around about me about, you know, awful things. I don't need to repeat that. And so I started to kind of figure out I was being used by this guy, and he was a cocaine dealer. And so that's kind of where things kind of went sideways. My mom came home one day and found my journal where I had been journaling about all of my happy trails and, you know, if you guys all know what that's all about, you know. And she read it all, and so then she knew all the things I was doing. And when I got home, all of my clothes were out on the front lawn. And she said, you can just go live with your dad. And so I went to live with my dad. My dad, also an alcoholic. And so he, we were living in Visalia at the time, and then we moved to Hanford. And that's where I met my first husband. It's actually in a bar. He was a bartender. And it was one of the bars in Hanford that served a lot of minors. And so we'd go there on the weekends and stuff, and they'd serve us. They had this drink. I think it was called the Stingray or something like that. It was a big bowl, and they just poured a bunch of booze in it, and everybody got a straw. And that's how we partied at that bar. And so this guy that I met, I fell head over heels because he was showing me attention. And so fast forward, my dad finds out that we're having relations. And so he tells the guy, you're either going to marry her or I'm going to report statutory rape. And I didn't want to marry him, but I didn't want him to go to jail. So I'm like, well, looks like we're going to have to get married, because he was in the Navy and he would have been court-martialed. And, you know, so my codependency kicks right in, you know. I'm like, let's just take care of you. And so we went to Reno and got married. And, you know, it's funny because God was trying to stop me the whole time. First of all, I had a brown dress to get married in. That should have been my first clue. Like, this is all going to be shitty. And then I tried to iron the dress because it was wrinkled from being in the bag. And I melted the dress with an iron print on the dress. And it was beautiful weather that day in Reno until we walked outside to walk across the street to the ye olde chapel And all of a sudden the wind comes up and it feels like it's like 30 or 40 miles per hour. I mean, I felt like my face was pressed back and I was, you know, walking against the wind. Like, talk about self-will. You know, I don't care if you have the brown dress, there's a burn hole in it, or God's creating a storm to stop you from going to the chapel. By God, I'm going, you know. He was very violent, very abusive. I was thrown in front of cars and beaten up and black eyes and all sorts of crazy stuff. He got out of the Navy and we went to South Carolina. And that's where things got really crazy because I was 3,000 miles away from home. And I would call my dad and I would say, I can't take it anymore. I need you to get me a plane and bring me home. And he'd say, okay. And he'd get me a ticket. And then I would say, never mind. And so I ended up having a baby because I, you know, had to prove to him that I could, because he would tell me, you know, you're damaged. You can never have a child. So I'm like, I'll show you, you know. So I had my son, when I was 18, and, then I called my, that's when I called my dad again. My husband pulled a gun on me, and he was going to shoot me. It was a little two-shooter Derringer, little hand, pearl-handled baby gun. Will still kill you, but, it didn't have safety on it. And he threw out some expletives and said, you know, that's it, you're gone. And I picked up a lamp. It was an early American lamp that had these scrolls, and it was iron. And I grabbed it by the hook at the top of it and flung it at him. And he ran and shut the door, and it went right through the door. And while that was going on, I'm running out the front door, went right through the screen door. And I got over to the neighbor across the street, and here's where God is there again, right? And this woman said, I had a feeling that that's what was going on in your house. And she said, I'm a survivor of domestic violence. And if you're expecting this to get better, it never will. So I called my dad, and I was freaking out because my son's in the house with this crazy man. And at that time, if you call the police, just so you know, sorry, we don't get involved, because prior to OJ, you could beat your wife and nobody gave a shit. And because that's how cops got hurt in domestic violence cases, so they didn't send cops there. And so I called my dad, and about the time he answered the phone, my ex-husband walked up and handed the baby to my neighbor and said, he's probably not mine anyway. She might as well take him. So he got me a ticket, and he said, if you don't get on that plane, don't call me again. And I knew he meant it. So I came back to California when my son was 3 months old and went back to school and got my GED. But, you know, here's what was going on. Like, all of the time I went without drinking while I was there, I would drink once in a while, but very rarely, because I felt like I needed to be on guard. I needed to know what the hell was going to come around the corner at any moment. But when I got home and I was safe, it was like, oh, thank God. And the drinking just kicked in. And it was like I had this second childhood. I just went completely crazy. And I wasn't a great mom. You know, I wasn't very nice to my son. I left him with my dad a lot. And I acted like I didn't have a child, you know, some of the time. And I'm not proud of that. And you would think that that would be enough for me to think, well, okay, it's time for me to get my shit together. But my son was almost 12 years old before I finally made it into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't realize until I got here that this man that I stayed in the relationship with this man for 2 years, and I was basically held captive. And I didn't realize if that's what was going on, but I was timed on how long it took me to go to the grocery store and come back. And there was times I would be sued in the cart because I knew I was going to be late coming home, and I'd get beat. So I would, you know, come home, and I got beat anyway. But I didn't realize how much that was still controlling my life, or the things that happened to me when I was a little girl. I didn't realize any of that stuff. I had no clue. I just thought I was drinking and using because that's what I like to do. But at some point, what ends up happening, or did for me, is that it stopped working. I started feeling worse about myself instead of better. I couldn't not feel the shame. I couldn't not feel the pain. I couldn't not feel the sadness. I was feeling more disconnected from people than connected to people. All the things that alcohol gave me, it took it away. And the final hoorah for me was I had this party at my house, and I bought all this booze, and I bought a bunch of pot. And I didn't even smoke pot, but, you know, I needed to draw people in. And nobody showed up. It was just me and one other person. And I thought, man, I can't even buy my friends, you know? And I think that was kind of the beginning of the end, realizing that I didn't drink like my friends. You know, I was the one that they were always saying, oh, don't mind her. She's just drinking. She's just drunk. She's just this, just that. And I had lots of different friends. I had different pockets of people that I hung out with, and none of them really met each other. So I was doing hair at the time, so I go to somewhere like the Vintage Press after work and go to happy hour with my work friends. But where I really liked to go was to the Shiloh Club in Tulare, where all the bikers hung out. And I would get behind the bar and make my own drinks. They weren't making them strong enough. And so I was a chameleon. I just kind of became whoever I needed to become. So I got to recovery on October 7th, 1988. And I haven't found it necessary to drink or use anything since that time. And I share that with you because, not to brag, but because I hear so many times that relapse is a part of recovery. And I have a different feeling about that. Relapse is not a part of recovery. Relapse is a part of your disease. But if you learn from the relapse, now it can become a part of your recovery. And then you share that message with other people on how they did it. How did you come back? How did you survive it? How did you get to the other side? I was taught you never look down on another alcoholic unless you're reaching your hand out to lift them up. And so it's that, you know, this is old time AA that was taught to me, you know. And even if you don't like what somebody's sharing, listen, because the next time you might be the guy that needs to talk. And you'll start thinking that nobody's listening. Why? Because if there's one finger pointing out, there's three more pointing back. And for every judgment I've ever had of anybody, it's come right back at me. You know, I don't have any reason to judge somebody else, but my head will still mug me. It will still try to make you less than me. And usually it's because I'm feeling like I don't belong, or I'm insecure, and I don't fit. And so my disease starts talking to me, and it'll either say, you know, you're better than, or it'll tell me I'm a piece of shit. You know, I know when my disease is active, when I'm not the same as you. So going back to coming in here, I actually came in because, I know this is an AA meeting, but I'm just going to have to throw this in. My brother and my now husband, who was just the guy that was living behind the couch at the time. There's not enough time in this meeting to go through all of it, but he was living behind the couch because he was parolee at large. So that's his story. But anyway, so they were going to meetings, and at one point my brother, you know, got some sobriety, and so did Rick. And so people were coming to our house, right? And I'm the one that I'm like, I don't have a problem. You guys are the ones with a problem. And so all these people were coming to our house, and we were having game nights and all sorts of stuff. And everybody would talk about those things we talk about, right? Like, oh, I remember that time I did this and how stupid that was. Oh, you know, oh my God, can you, you know, and they would all be talking about that stuff, right? And I would think to myself, oh my God, I've done that. Oh, you know, so, I was at a hair show. I was a hairdresser at the time, and, I was at a hair show over at the Holiday Inn, which is now the Wyndham, and was sitting there in the bar talking about my friend, not very nicely, because she had just got her car repossessed and her husband got taken to the ER for an overdose. And we were both going, oh, can you believe her, right? And I go home, and it's my brother's birthday, October 3rd. And all of the people in my life that were my problems were all sober. And I had this moment of clarity that all of my crap, all of the stuff, all of the people I was blaming, it wasn't them. It wasn't them. It was me. So I went to my first meeting on October 6th. And I drank that night because I was like, holy shit, I have a problem and I belong there. And the girl that I was with was trying to convince me that I didn't belong here because she drank like I drank. And if I'm an alcoholic, she's an alcoholic. So you don't have a problem. What are you talking about? You're fine. You are still able to work and all of this stuff. And it's like, no, it's more than that. And so there weren't many women in this program or any other program for that matter. It was, I would say, 90% men. So finding a sponsor in 1988 was like finding a needle in the haystack. There weren't enough meetings in AA or NA to do a meeting every single day, so you had to mix up your meetings. And so when they said do 90 meetings in 90 days, my first thought was, you guys have lost your mind. Like, I have a life. I don't know what you guys do, you know, but I'm a mom and I have a job and, you know, I'm important, don't you know? And they said, well, if you want to be sober, you're going to do what we do. So they said, you get a book and you read it and you go to a meeting every day for 90 days and you get a sponsor and you get a sponsor that has worked the 12 steps and that sponsor has a sponsor. And today I have a sponsor and my sponsor has a sponsor and her sponsor has a sponsor. And it doesn't matter how long you've been in this program, if you don't continue to work, this is my experience. Let me just rephrase this. Doing the 10th step tonight, I don't want to have to make amends. If I don't continue to work with a sponsor, my disease becomes more powerful than my recovery. And I've had that happen since I've been here. There was a period of time, I want to say it was about about 5 years ago where I was feeling really crazy. And every meeting I was in, I was just crying. In fact, one of the guys used to say, what's wrong, Jerry? You didn't cry tonight, you know? And I was just a mess. I would sit in the back of the room. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to hug anybody. I didn't want to share a meeting. I just felt awful. And I realized that I had gotten disconnected because my sponsor was a traveling nurse. And so she was always in another country or something. I would talk with my hands. So I'm sorry, you guys, if I'm like whacking and you're trying to, hear me and I'm bopping the mic. Sorry. She had been my sponsor since I was just a little bit less than 2 years sober. And so at about, I think it was about 28 years is when I said, I really feel like I need to get a new sponsor. And she said, I want you to do whatever you got to do. And so she's still one of my dearest friends. But what ended up happening is I had gone through some sponsors and seemed like the sponsors were attached to whatever boy I was dating. And so then, and I say boy, because they really weren't men. No, really. They were old chronologically, but maturity, no. So every time I would break up with somebody, I'd lose a sponsor, or they would find a guy and then they'd move away, or, you know, something was happening. And so I picked my first sponsor, Jackie, up, the one I had for a long time, and she was speaking at an event, and I said, man, I got all this step work to go over, and I don't have anybody to go over it with. And she goes, you want me to be your sponsor? And I go, I mean, I was like starstruck because, you know, she's now about 45 years. And I said, okay. And she talked really fast. Like, and then she would say, you got it? And I'd say, yep. And then I'd leave going, no idea what she freaking said. But I learned so many amazing things from her and the steps, because I want to make sure that I, you know, get sober here and share some messages of recovery. Is, you know, the first three steps get jumped over really quickly as if they're not important. And what I believe is that many people that relapse because they really haven't gotten a firm grasp of step one. You know, I'm powerless over anything that changes me from the neck up. And so I can't put anything in my body. I just can't. And that's for me, you know, that's the way I was taught. And if I think that I can control something, and so right now in my life, what I think I can control is everybody. Because it's, you know, it's not my drinking now, it's my thinking that I'm powerless over. And I realized, like, every time I do a 10-step at the end of the night, it's, you know, I've told somebody else what to do, or, you know, I'll do it, you know, take control, take charge of things, because that's what I do, you know. And and I also learned in that first step is that the only thing I really have control over is the amount of time and attention I give to something. And if I give a lot of time and attention to something, I'm giving it power. So be careful, I tell myself, be careful how much time and attention you focus on that. Is that really something you want to bring into your life? And then I only have control over my perception about that. So I have to ask my higher power to change my perception about this thing that I might be getting mad at or irritated with. And so most of the time it's because I'm spotting something in you that belongs, it's in me, you know. And so I ask God to show me what's inside of me that I'm not willing to look at. And then the other is my actions around that. So I have control over my actions. And so I can't really say anymore, oh, you know, it's because I was drunk. You know, I can't use that as an excuse anymore. Or I can't say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm powerless. No, there are things I have control over, and it's right here from the nose back. You know, it's me. And if my focus, attitude, and behavior start to affect other people, then I have to do something about that. It usually starts to affect me first, and I ignore it. And then it gets big enough that it's starting to affect you, and I see it on your face, you know, with the scowl or the, you know, or nobody's calling me, things like that. And then in the second step, you know, there's nothing here that says that I have to believe in a specific higher power, but I do have to find something that's bigger than me. Because, again, my other drug of choice is control. So if I don't find something other than myself to believe in that has more power than I do, then I live in fear. And when I live in fear, I'm not willing to give anything to God because I've got my claw marks all over it. And in that fourth and fifth step, I get to find out what my values are. You see, for me, I adopted all of your values and all of your morals, and they didn't fit me. And I never told anybody what mine were because I didn't know what they were. But if you violated them, I sure as hell knew it. Because you then went on the fuck you list and you didn't get talked to anymore. And so that's how that party I had where nobody showed up, it's because they were all on the fuck you list. Okay? So I don't want to have those lists anymore. You know, recovery is about healing relationships with people, not burying them, not discarding them and throwing them away. Because, you know, I don't, like, I'm going to go back to what I said when I first started. I don't have any reason to judge anybody. I got enough in my own coat closet, you know? So when I'm judging somebody else, it's me looking at me, you know? You spot it, you got it. So in my writing, I'm seeing a lot of my character defects in that step six and step seven. And even though I've gone through the steps multiple times, there's something really profound that's happening for me this time. And I have been one of those people who would go through periodic times of balking. You know, it says that in the book. And I would balk. Oh, that won't work for me. You might need to do that daily writing, but not me, you know. And I would go for a little while. I'd do that 50-yard dash, you know, and I'd do it for a while, and then I would stop, and then I'd meet with my sponsor, and then I'd have to ask myself, am I going to lie or am I going to be truthful? Oh, I'm going to have to tell her the truth, and I bet she's going to fire me. See, so I realized what was going on is I was trying to sabotage the relationship. And I finally got it that the relationship with her was really important to me. So stop trying to sabotage the relationship. So I had the assignment to do my 10th step every night for 14 days, and then we couldn't meet for a while, and I had to get to that place. Oh, my 14 days is up. Maybe I could just stop this writing. But I realized in the writing that I had done that some spiritual awakenings were happening. And I had always kind of felt like I was missing some of that connection with my higher power. And in writing in that 10th step, I realized what was happening was that the barrier between me and my higher power was being dissolved. And I was really liking the payoff I was getting from it. And I have done daily writing before, but see, this here's my character defect, arrogance. I've been sober for quite a while now. I'm thinking maybe I don't have to do that. No. You will get just as crazy at 30 years or 31 or 32 or 33 years sober if you stop doing this work. That's my experience. That's why I was sitting in the back of the room not wanting to talk to anybody and not wanting to connect with anybody. I didn't realize it, but I was on my way out the door. I didn't relapse. I stayed sober. But it was the first time in my recovery that I felt like I was getting so close to it that it scared me. And I've had a lot of big things that have happened since I've been here. Both of my parents have passed away. My dad died of brain cancer when I was, I want to say, I think it was 7 years sober. I got married to my husband. That was before my father died, thank God. My son went to jail. In 2014, my mom passed away. 2013, the doctor told me I was going to die, that I had cancer and I was terminal. I'm still here. So, not my current doctor anymore, let's just say that. And my husband was diagnosed with Hep C right after we got married. And he went on the alpha interferon, for any of you that have been around long enough to know, that's like, you're lucky if that doesn't kill you. You know, there's just been a lot of stuff. You know, we went through almost losing our business a couple of times, and no matter what, I just don't put anything in it. You know, I just know that not anything that is happening in my life, drinking would make better. It never will. It only makes it worse for me, and it blows up everybody else's life around me. My granddaughter is now going to be a senior in high school. She's never seen me under the influence. My son got married and married a woman with 4 children. And we have a multicultural family, and they are all my grandchildren. I can't even go over everything, you know. But what I know today is that I never had a relationship that really lasted longer than about 3 months, because I was more addicted to the honeymoon phase, where nobody gets out of bed for like 3 months, you know. And then you come up for air and you see the guy and go, oh, damn. This isn't going to be good. You know, and then my sponsor gave me an assignment. She said, before you bump any ugly things together, you have to spend time with this person and not do anything but talk for 30 days. And I was like, oh my God, I'm never having sex again. And she said, you're going to need to have a talk about sex. You're going to need to talk about sex, what your boundaries are around sex. I'm like, no, that's not going to happen. So I was celibate for a long time. I realized that I was having sex with people because I was bored. There was nothing left to talk about, and I didn't know what else to do, and I didn't know how to, you know, say goodnight. And so, you wanna? And I'm really, really grateful that she gave me that assignment, because otherwise it would be really shameful for me to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and see all the guys I did, you know. So if you're new, I'm just going to share with you, like, this is the last house on the block. Don't run yourself out of here, man. Like, you know, this whole free love bullshit, like, I grew up with that in the 60s and 70s, okay? There ain't nothing free. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't have relationships, and we're new. We take hostages. So, you know, I'm really grateful, because I would see all of these other people that were having relationships, and I would look through this photo album, and I was like, oh, that's when so-and-so was with so-and-so, and that's when so-and-so was with so-and-so, and here's Jerry, and here's Jerry, and here's Jerry, and I'm feeling all sorry for myself, like, how come I'm always by myself? Am I like the ugly duckling or what, you know? And And no, I heard somebody say I'm strong. No, I was not strong. I was like, please take me, take me. And the problem was I was desperate, and I think people like spotted that. I don't know. I ended up marrying my best friend. My husband was my friend before we even got sober. He was my brother's best friend, and there was a rule my brother had, and I know I'm almost out of time, sorry, but there was a rule my brother had that you could never date his sister, you know. So I, all through my high school years, none of his friends would date me because they were like, we're your brother, we're not your, you know, boyfriend. And I'm like, that sucked, right? And so I felt kind of guilty because Rick and I went to this race. I'll share this with you. So we go to this race in Bakersfield because I like watching race cars. And so we go to this race in Bakersfield, and he's got his little doping Toyota pickup. And it was a Toyota, right? Yeah. And so it was yellow. And so we go to this thing, and like the whole way, I'm like, you would think I did meth before I left. I was so nervous the whole way. And so we get there, and he buys the ticket for both of us. And I'm like, what did you do that for? That's what I'm thinking in my head. What did you do that for? What did you do that for? And so then we get inside, and we're sitting next to each other, and I could feel the angst, you know, like where you're afraid to relax your back, you know, you're just like, like a soldier, you know, because I might touch him or something, you know, and I don't want to touch him. I want him to know, you know, and so we had this conversation about sexual boundaries. First of all, my therapist said, you know, if you think you like him, then why don't you tell him? And I'm like, what? I can't tell him, I'll get rejected. And she said, well, better to know now than later, right? And I said, I'm afraid it's going to ruin our relationship. We're good friends. And she said, well, then it won't ruin your relationship. So we're sitting outside of an AA meeting in that little dope food truck. And I said, so I'm kind of noticing that our hugs are more than AA hugs. And he goes, yep. And if you know my husband, he's a man of many words. And I said, so does that mean that you like me too? Like, I kind of like you. I wonder if you liked me. I feel like I was in fifth grade. And we haven't even kissed yet. You guys, we haven't even kissed yet. Like, this is so foreign, right? Because, like I told you, I'm usually like figuring it out later. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, relationships are too hard to start and too painful to end. And I don't know where this is going to go, but I'm willing to give it a shot if you are. And I said, well, okay. And all the way back to my car, okay, this is pre-cell phone. All the way back to my car, I'm like, what just happened? And I get in my car and I can't call anybody, right? Like, I'm just in my car with my alcoholic mind. Oh, my God. I'm in a relationship with him. Oh, my God. And so before we got married, he said something about living together. And I said, I'm not living with anybody unless I'm married. And he goes, I would marry you. Oh. And then I just acted like I didn't hear it. And so we went to dinner at Sizzler, and there was this old couple, probably our age right now, sitting in the booth across. And I said, so I got to ask you, like, the other night when you said you'd marry me, like, was that a proposal? And he goes, well, would you say yes? Like, talk about nobody wanting to commit, right? And I said, well, you haven't asked. And so then he asked me, and I said, yes. And so We've been married now on July 9th, will be 24. Yeah. Beginning onset of Alzheimer's. I'm very grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm really grateful that I get to keep the same recovery date I came in here with. And I've had some surgeries, you know, and I seriously think that God just did for me what I couldn't do for myself. So I'll tell you what was said to me, which is always do what you don't want to do when you don't want to do it. If you don't want to work a step, work it. You don't want to go to a meeting, go. You don't want to call somebody, call. You don't want to get up and read your meditation, do it. Whatever it is you're balking at, just do it. Because eventually it's going to be a part of your daily routine, and that discipline is what's going to keep you sober. Get a sponsor. Call them. I've given my phone number out to hundreds of people over the last 33 years. I think maybe four or five have actually called. We don't do that just because, you know, there's a bunch of numbers to put on a paper. That's there for you to call. And if you have a sponsor and you're not working steps, you don't have a sponsor. So get a sponsor, get the book, read it, you know, do the deal. And then, and only then, if you think that it was better out there than it is in here, we'll gladly refund your misery. But don't go before you've done it, man. Like contempt prior to investigation, all you're doing is doing time here to go back and start over. And you're not going to pick up where you left off. It's going to be worse than that. And you'll be lucky if you make it back. You know, I've seen too many people die, and I don't want to see any more people die. So please keep coming back, and thanks for listening.